Hi, I'm Jo Varaka. Welcome to Unripe, where I talk to experts and women like you and me as we find a place in the world and a community of women who are childless by circumstance or child-free by choice. I'm going to talk about IVF, being single and childless and married like me, or in a relationship, abortion, losing friends to motherhood, and all the topics that people just don't like to talk about. So let's make these conversations part of the mainstream. Come on, join me. Hello and welcome back to Unripe. I'm Jo Varaka. Like so many in our community, I discover lots of new voices on Instagram. And even though we're apart, either because of distance or because of lockdowns, the childless community really rallies online. Tanya Hubbard came to my attention because she talks about toxic positivity and post-traumatic growth in a way that makes sense to me. She's also a counsellor with lived experience of childlessness, which is really hard to find. And she also talks about grief. So I wanted to understand what it all means and how we can manage it in our day-to-day lives. Tanya and her husband live in Vancouver, Canada, and like Australia, they have a really robust public healthcare system. But like us, there's long waiting periods for elective non-emergency surgery, and it certainly doesn't offer IVF. Tanya explains that, like so many of us, she didn't start trying to get pregnant until her mid to late 30s. And by that time, she learned she had a massive fibroid that needed attention before she could even think of trying to carry a baby. As always with guests, I'm curious about what brought them to this space, how they came to be childless, not by choice, and what they're doing instead. So let's hear from Tanya.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. I guess I can just start with, what brought me here? So I am childless, not by choice, moving into the world of child-free after infertility. And, you know, it changes each day. My husband and I started to try to conceive, and we are late bloomers. So we were already late in the game when we started to try. I was in my 30s, in my later 30s, and we also aren't really on top of things. So we tried, and then it kind of reached a point where I was like, this feels like this is taking too long. So I went to the doctor, and she was like, alarm bells, oh no, and sent me to a fertility clinic. And they started to just investigate, and they found a really large fibroid. So it turned out that I had an 18 centimeter fibroid on my uterus. And so they were like, you need to stop trying to conceive because a baby wouldn't survive, and get this out. So the way that the healthcare system works here, that surgery is covered for me, but I had to wait in line, and I had to wait 8 months to have that surgery. I had that fibroid removal 8 months later.
According to the Mayo Clinic, uterine fibroids are non-cancerous growths of the uterus that often appear during childbearing years. And they're also called, I'm just going to pronounce this slowly, leiomyomas. Or myomas. Uterine fibroids aren't associated with an increased risk of uterine cancer and almost never develop into cancer. So fibroids range in size from seedlings, undetectable by the human eye, to bulky masses that can distort and enlarge the uterus. You can have a single fibroid or multiple fibroids. In extreme cases, multiple fibroids can expand the uterus so much that it reaches the ribcage. Many women have uterine fibroids sometime during their lives, but you might not know you have them because they often have no symptoms. Your doctor might discover fibroids incidentally during a pelvic exam or prenatal ultrasound, which is how I learned I had them. And I've had fibroids removed a couple of times over the years. In women who have symptoms, the most common signs and symptoms of uterine fibroids include heavy menstrual bleeding, menstrual periods that last more than a week, pelvic pressure or pain, frequent urination, difficulty emptying the bladder, constipation, backache or leg pain, and a few things like that. Rarely, a fibroid can cause acute pain when it outgrows its blood supply and begins to die. And as ever, when in doubt, see your doctor.
I had painful periods, but other than that, I was completely unaware. So it was a shocker to discover that. It really is kind of mind-boggling to me. And to this day, I'm kind of confused as to where it was pre-COVID. I was thinner, so I don't understand how it wasn't visible. Because, you know, I can tell if I've eaten a burger, but somehow I couldn't tell. So anyway, I had to wait an additional 8 months after having tried to conceive for close to 2 years before we sought help. Another 8 months to get this fibroid removed. They did a couple tests prior and were like, oh yeah, everything's going to be great as soon as you get this out. They were like, oh, you're fertile. So we'll just have to get this out and then you're going to have no problem. So it was like, okay, well, that's great. Basically, as soon as we were allowed to start trying again after healing from that surgery, I did get pregnant, but I miscarried. The doctors were like, okay, well, don't worry about it because you can get pregnant. So keep trying. So another big chunk of time went with us trying, but then I never did get pregnant again. So another year later, it was like, okay, we've been trying for a year since I lost that pregnancy. Let's move forward with fertility treatments. They were so nonchalant about it, even pre-surgery. They were like, you know, because I was like, oh, I've got to wait 8 months for this surgery. Should we freeze my eggs? What should we do? I was so oblivious to how anything worked. I was just a newbie that was naive. And they're like, no. Like, you'll just get pregnant after this. And I did. It's true. They were right about that. So we made the choice to move on to fertility treatments. And we did 3 rounds of fertility treatments and none of them took. The last round I knew was my last round. And it was expensive financially, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, physically. And I was done.
Tanya did 3 rounds of fertility treatment like me, and none of them were successful. Research suggests most couples will need around 6 embryo transfers before they achieve a pregnancy through IVF. In the UK, and let's face it, on average, researchers have found that around 65% of women under 40 will be successful after 6 or more cycles of IVF. So even if you're in Australia, where some of your IVF cycle is covered if you have private insurance, that could set you back thousands. So here's some info. Ovulation induction, $700 per cycle out of pocket. An IVF cycle is round 1 of treatment, which starts with the first day of menstruation. A cycle is typically 1 week with 1 to 3 shots a day for those who have difficulties ovulating naturally. This fee does not include IVF-related medication. The first IVF cycle in the calendar year costs between $9,000 and $10,000, but it could be as much as $15,000, with around $4,600 as an out-of-pocket expense after insurance. Subsequent cycles in the same calendar year cost, on average, $4,000 as an out-of-pocket expense. Frozen embryo transfer is around $3,650, with about $2,200 of this as an out-of-pocket cost. Other costs that Medicare does not cover include freezing your embryos, which is around $1,000 for 12 months of storage, freezing sperm, which is around $450 for 6 months of storage, and surgical sperm collection, which can be anywhere between $670 to $1,000. You know, I hate maths and numbers, so I won't add it up. Let's just say that when I did IVF 15 years ago, even with a Medicare rebate and private insurance, 3 cycles cost around $20,000 out of pocket. Okay, enough of those numbers. The reason why women stop trying is innumerable. A lot of the times it's based on resources. Seriously, you just run out of energy and money.
For me, I'd made the decision that that was my last try, but I was still so, so damn hopeful and believed that it was really, really possible. I was doing different things. So there was a lot of possibility in there and hopefulness. I hadn't felt relief yet. I was still in the stage of, well, I'm giving this my final go and I'm trying everything. And I tried like everything. Oh my goodness. I tried acupuncture. I tried shamans. I tried IV therapy, like IV therapy being nutrients being injected right in through my bloodstream. I also had like lucky charms that my fertile friends insisted were the reasons why they kept having babies. So I had those, which are now long gone in the garbage. I drank a lot of things that tasted like the ground. And I've used alternative medicines for other things that have worked. So I'm like, it's not the acupuncture that didn't work. It's the IVF that didn't work. Let's be clear. I'm not going to blame acupuncture for this problem.
So you're one of the 30% with unexplained infertility.
That was the diagnosis, was unexplained. And, you know, when there's any argument against that, then they chalk it up to age.
Tanya is a coach and counselor, and while many of her clients come to her for reasons that are unrelated to infertility, she also saw a need to focus more on the underserved childless population.
And my own experience of trying to find resources, it was so difficult. You know, you find the handful of people that thank God for them and I love them. And I knew that there needed to be more. And so as I processed my own grief and shame, because there was an immense amount of shame around it, I realized that I wanted to be part of lifting that veil of shame and being a space where that person like me, who at 3 a.m. has insomnia because of their infertility, or not just infertility, but their childlessness, where they can find a little bit of respite from the grief, seeing themselves reflected back in my words.
What's it like counseling women about childless grief while you're processing your own grief over the same thing? It really must be difficult.
Yeah, I like that question because I'm not done with my grief and I never will be. My belief around grief is that we always have it. It just shifts and changes as we shift and change and grow. So what it's like for me is that it's really healing for me to work with people who are going through things that are similar. And, you know, everyone's story is like a fingerprint. You know, we have the same overarching experience of not having children. And then other than that, that's just like a portal into everyone else's very unique experiences. But there are really relatable things. And I find it healing for me because I see myself in them sometimes. I find some things triggering and I have to just use my counseling skills that we learn in school about how to deal with things that when it's close to home. So an example for me is friendships. Friendships have really suffered through my infertility and everyone around me seeming to have no problem. And so for me, that also comes up universally in my sessions with people who are dealing with this issue. It always comes up. So I have to navigate it by very, very much removing myself from the situation. And essentially, other than the empathy, because I can relate, work with it as if I don't know it, because their situation is different than mine. As a general rule, I work from a person-centered lens. So the client has the answers within them. I don't have answers. I just have some skills and knowledge. And I also have endless amounts of empathy, validation, and unconditional positive regard. So often what happens in the therapeutic relationship is what somebody is needing in their outside relationships and they're not getting. So I can also offer that within the therapeutic relationship, is provide this empathy and validation that they're not getting from their friends. When they're in the muck of it and that's what they need, they can process their grief and then kind of come out of the muck and then move forward.
So I now have the language around disenfranchised grief, as I'm sure you do too, but that only just came in the last couple of years. Does it come as a surprise to your clients when they realize that what they're feeling is grief?
Yes, totally. It's so normal to have that experience. And it's such a big part of that healing process is naming it as grief, because that's self-validating to realize, oh, this is what it is. This isn't just like I'm bummed or things didn't go my way or whatever other way that we internalize the way society tells us to just get over it or whatever. To be able to learn what grief is and that this is grief. And in fact, it's extra difficult because it is disenfranchised grief. And just for your listeners to be clear, that's grief that isn't recognized or honored by society. So if I'm grieving this thing, but everyone around me doesn't acknowledge it or honor it, then how lonely is that? So not only am I in my grief, but I'm also super isolated in my grief. So no one's bringing me lasagnas and asking me how I'm doing.
Tanya, you talk about post-traumatic growth and the idea that you can find meaning from trauma. Can you please tell us a bit more about that?
It's this idea of, you know, we can go through traumas, and I'll include grief in there, that as we grow and process, we can come out quote unquote, the other side and actually experience growth as opposed to just being like, oh, I'm okay with it. I've survived it. Post-traumatic growth allows us to create meaning and have a new sense of self and understanding maybe about our perspectives of the world, maybe something even more existential sometimes. And it's not a requirement in healing and it's not for everyone, but it is a really beautiful thing that can happen when people process trauma and grief.
Something that comes up with couples is a lack of communication around fertility. I know when Jeff and I were being treated, we talked about the daily needs, like when to take my temperature, doctor's appointments, needles, but we didn't talk much about what was actually happening because all of the technical stuff became our language for a few years. And later, it kind of just didn't come up much other than angry remarks and some tears. So how do we talk about it?
I definitely would get curious about, well, what's going on for you that you're not talking about it? Who's protecting who? What are you afraid of? I would just get curious about that. You know, I think a lot of the time it's just that it's just uncomfortable. Sometimes I think people are so exhausted with dealing with it that when they're with their partner at the end of the day, they just want to turn on the TV and chill and not talk about this because they're depleted. I also think, you know, in my experience of talking to plenty of women, they want their partner, their male partner, to process the same way they do. And we just have to recognize that I'm really careful to not gender things too much, but that's another human being and they're processing it differently. They have a lifetime of experiences that are informing the way they're processing it in a different way than your lifetime of experiences are. And then the societal pressures are different. And yeah, number one, I would say communicate if you can. And if it feels like you can't, what's going on there that you're not communicating? Why are you not talking about it? If someone's pursuing fertility treatments, it is so technical and there are so many things you need to do. And I think it puts us in our part of our brain of like, well, I just got to get stuff done. And we don't really drop into the feeling. We're so in like goal mode that we don't really drop into our feelings and check in with like, what is this doing to me? What's this doing to you? What's this doing to us? How beautiful would it be if we did that more in the process? And I don't think that's the most common thing because we're busy ticking off the boxes.
In your experience, those people who do stay together, because obviously, you know, relationships break up and things like infertility can hasten that. The people who do stay together, that their relationship tends to strengthen over time? Or am I just imagining that because that's my experience?
No, you're not imagining it because it is your experience. And I think it's actually quite common that people have that experience. I'm trepidatious to just land on that and stay there because it also puts tremendous pressure on a relationship. And some people years out are still dealing with the aftermath and don't feel like the relationship was strengthened and in fact are still scrambling to try and keep it together.
Enjoy what you're hearing? Go ahead and leave a review. A nice one, please. Right here on the app you're listening on. Reviews on Apple Podcasts in particular make it easier for others to find us. But wherever you are is just fine. And thank you. Tanya, as a counsellor with experience with infertility, you're quite rare. Why do you think that is? And why aren't there more therapists and mental health experts who specialise in this type of grief and who are one of us?
I mean, it's a really good question and I don't have a succinct answer. There's a piece that a lot of people, even who are in the mental health profession, haven't processed it themselves and so can't go help others. I think that there is an internalized idea that this isn't that big of a deal and therefore you move on. You know, it just happens. Mental health professionals are human and we internalize things too. So I think that's part of it. I think that there's also the piece that somebody has experienced so much grief and trouble around it. They want to move on and they don't want to focus on it anymore. It just takes over your life for a period of time. When you're ready to move on from it, you might just not want it in your life at all anymore. And then I think there's also an aspect of when somebody starts to feel better, they're like, oh, moving on, what's next? Because I'm okay now. And I think that happens within our community, not just in the mental health portion of it, but whether it's accounts or blogs or podcasts, I don't know, people are like, oh, I'm good now and I don't want to talk about this anymore.
We mentioned toxic positivity recently and it's everywhere, like hashtag IVF warriors or hashtag endo warriors. It's this idea that we must persist against all odds. If we don't persist, then we have just obviously given up. We need to be grateful for what we do have and forget the rest. I mean, this idea of gratitude is great, but it's becoming all-consuming and toxic, hasn't it?
Toxic positivity is a way of bypassing what somebody's feeling. So if another person inserts some kind of positive message onto me without my choosing, that's toxic positivity. And what it does is it doesn't allow a person to feel what they're really feeling. If we don't get to really feel what we're feeling, then we're stuck with it. We are humans with multiple emotions and we have them all for a reason. And so to just go through life only seeking happiness and only experiencing happiness, we're missing the multitude of ingredients that makes us human. And if we bypass our grief or our anger or our rage or whatever else it is with saying like, just be positive, never give up, it'll all work out, God never gives you anything you can't handle, and so on, then what it's ultimately saying is stop feeling what you're feeling. Stop it. Don't feel what you're feeling. Just think of the good stuff. And that doesn't serve us.
What do you say to people when they're doing that to you? I just get angry. Mm-hmm. What's a better way of dealing with toxic positivity?
Well, a great way would be to express your needs. So to model it, it might look like, you know, I know you don't like seeing me sad, but right now I need to be sad and I need you to let me be. If you acknowledge what they're doing, their intent is that they want you to be happy, right? So you can be like, thank you. Thank you for wanting me to be okay. But for me to be okay right now, I actually need to feel my feelings.
We talk about the idea of being child-free after infertility. Where are you sitting at this moment?
Ooh, well, today I'm definitely feeling child-free because I had a packed day professionally and I just have a little French bulldog that's been nagging at me to take her out. And that's kind of all I can fit into my day today. So today I'm grateful that my life is the way it is. And I guess where I'm at, me being okay with my life never changes the fact that I really, really wanted it. Nothing can touch that. And it's something that I say to clients all the time too, because when they're trying to get past the wanting and the trying and processing the grief, there is a very real fear. And this is in grief in general, whether it's losing a loved one who's passed away, whether it's miscarriage, is a fear that if I'm not in my deep sadness anymore, it devalues that loss. But nothing can touch how much you cared. Just because you find a way to move forward doesn't make that thing not exist. So yeah, I guess in a convoluted way, that's me saying that I feel like I'm in a good place. And, you know, I still don't know all my triggers. Sometimes I get blindsided by something and go, wow, I didn't know that one would hit me. And it's like this never ending, like lifting up rocks and looking under them and discovering like, oh, under that one, there's that. And under this one, there's nothing.
I found a lot of growth through blogging and this podcast, and I'm sure it's helped a lot of other women to write or illustrate their way through their stories. Would you recommend that as a way of moving forward for other people?
A lot of people find relief from blogs and Instagram and social media, and then they start to feel like, oh, well, that's where I'm getting the relief. So maybe I should start an account and I should do this. And there's no should. Does that feel helpful to you? Because you don't owe anyone anything. You don't owe anyone your story. You don't owe anyone education. Just because you've experienced whatever it is that brought you to childlessness doesn't mean that you have to be the spokesperson for it. You are welcome to go off and never talk about it again. That's the beauty of social media as well, is that people are finding their community where they actually do feel validated and seen. And so they're ready to use their voice and tell their story because the people in their life aren't ready to listen. So they're finding people who will listen and who get it. So it really is individual.
And Tanya, thank you so much for being someone who is telling her story and is helping other women through their grief and also telling their stories. You know, I agree with you, not everyone has to do that, but I'm so grateful for those of you who are doing that. Thank you so much. You know, it might seem that we're all telling the same story, that we've heard it all before. But what I've learned over the years is that sometimes you need to hear the same message told multiple times in multiple different ways, because it might just be that third or 10th or 57th time that helps it click for you. I want to thank Tanya for spending time with me today. And you can find Tanya on Instagram at Tanya Hubbard Counseling. You can also check out her website for her services. Head over to tanyahubbard.com. I'll leave a link in the show notes. Thanks for joining me. Bye. I'd love you to join the community on Facebook and Instagram, which is at Unripe Community. And if you're childless or child-free, you're welcome to join the private group, which you'll find a link to on the Facebook page. If you want to share a story or let me know what topics you'd like to hear more about, please drop me an email at hellounripe@gmail.com. And don't forget, if you enjoyed the show, leave a review on your favorite podcast app, including iTunes and Spotify, so other people can find it. The website is where you'll find a little bit more about me, plus all the show notes. Go to unripecommunity.com.au.